right. So, is this on? It's on. Okay. We are on the section known as Early American Presbyterianism. So we're particularly looking at that time leading up to the formation of our country. In other words, most of what we're going to be talking about is prior 1776, prior actually being an official nation. This is more like colonial days. And just as a reminder or kind of refresh your memory, what are the two biggest groups of people that initially formed mainline American Presbyterianism? We mentioned this in a couple different ways. What are those two main groups of people? The English? What kind of English particularly? Okay. I was actually, those are the two different groups actually. I'm sorry. Say the English Puritans, that's right. And then what were the other ones you said? Scotch-Irish Presbyterians, we'll say, yeah. So Scots-Irish Presbyterians and the English Puritans largely came together to make up our roots for American Presbyterianism. So as we think about colonial days of America, let's think a little bit about some of the initial beginnings for the Presbyterian Church. So you notice in your outline there, it says that there are various reports of independent new church plants with Presbyterian convictions and ideals in the 17th century. In other words, when you look into the mid and late 1600s, you can see churches that are starting to pop up, church plants that have pastors and doctrinal convictions that would line up with what we would call Presbyterian. And they weren't, in other words, Congregationalists, they weren't Anglican, they really would line up with what we would call as Presbyterian in terms of their theology. So as I mentioned there, you have some in Long Island, some in New Jersey and Maryland, and then some in Pennsylvania and Delaware. And the first Presbyterian minister that we know of was in New York named Francis Doughty. I think that's the right pronunciation, is that right? Of his name there, Francis Doughty, a New England Puritan who was there in 1642. And interesting about him is he was a New England Puritan, and he came to New York there for religious freedom. One of the views that caused him a lot of difficulty before was infant baptism, which of course is something that Presbyterians believe in. And guess where he got persecuted for infant baptism? Actually, I find my own, I've lost my own places here. I'll tell you this, it wasn't in Europe. It was in Massachusetts, sorry. I don't know about you, but when I think of the colonists coming to America, I think that they came for what? Religious freedom, right? And to go away from Europe where they get persecuted. And there's a sense in which that's very true. But see, for example, in Massachusetts, they came there for religious freedom, but they wanted to be able to say, this now is the religious viewpoint, and essentially say, you can't have freedom to do anything you want, because they came from an environment where the government had quite a lot of control over what the church taught. And so these colonies started up and started to organize the church the way they wanted, but a lot of the colonies said, we've organized the way we wanted, and this is the way it's going to be. And so someone like Francis Doughty was not free in Massachusetts to teach infant baptism, got persecuted, and came to New York where he had more freedom. Another one of these early ministers was Matthew Hill. He was a Presbyterian minister in Maryland in 1669. And one of the things we see from him is he writes this letter. Maybe you've heard of Richard Baxter. Richard Baxter is an English Puritan, rather well-known, written a number of books that Reformed Presbyterians think very highly of and quote and make use of. And so Richard Baxter is probably a name we've all heard of. Matthew Hill is maybe not such a common name, but one of the things he's known for is he writes a rather passionate plea back to Richard Baxter, who's back in Britain, basically saying, this ground needs ministers of the Reformed faith. Please use your influence to send some more out here. And not necessarily that he would send him like foot the bill per se, but he's an influential guy. Help spread the word. We need ministers. And I'll even read you an excerpt of his letter to Baxter. He says, "We have many of the Reformed religion who have a long while lived as sheep without a shepherd. We have room for more ministers because we are where the people and the plantations are the thickest. It is judged by some that two or three itinerant preachers with no dependence on the people for maintenance would be eminently instrumental among them. We cannot but judge it as a duty to come over and help us." So you notice, by the way, saying, particularly if you could send ministers that don't need financial support. this is a problem we'll see going on in the early days of America, is really a shortage of ministers. We'll talk a little bit more about it today, and I think you'll find it going through some of the future lessons as well, and some of the reasons why we had those difficulties. That's certainly some of the beginnings in the colony days. We see these initial church plants pop up. And yet something, when we look at those things and say, is that the beginning of Presbyterianism? We have to say it's the initial beginnings, but it's certainly not a formal beginning. Because what's the glaring problem with those church plants if they want to call themselves Presbyterian? What do you think, Mike? There's no presbytery. That's right. One of the things that makes a Presbyterian, there's many things, we've talked about that, but the very name itself speaks to the government of the church, that the churches are connected together with regional governing groups called presbyteries, so that at every level there is a government of a plurality of elders. That's what the word presbyter means. It's the Greek word for elder. So the local church is ran by elders, and then there's regional groups that govern called presbyteries that are commissioners of elders from all the churches, and then they have a national gathering called synod or general assembly where the presbyteries each send commissioners of elders so that at every level there's elders ruling the church collectively. And well, by the very definition, then they can't be Presbyterian yet, even though they have these Presbyterian convictions, because right now they're all just independent churches trying to make their way in the new world. And with that matter, I think it's important to note that unlike some other church plants, these churches did not have a mother church back in Europe. So Mike mentioned last week the Covenanters. The Covenanters, for example, they sent some ministers over here and made some church plants, and over time have become what's known as the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church. And so that was one example of a smaller denomination that did ultimately take root and had some other influences, but they actually had a mother church to start with that kind of helped with the initial organization versus mainline American Presbyterianism didn't have that mother church connection. I think that's helpful to know for our history. So those are some of the initial beginnings. Any questions on that so far? So things begin to formalize and take off on what actually looks more Presbyterian then, beginning in 1706. In 1706, there was the first presbytery formed, the Presbytery of Philadelphia. And it had its first meeting. Someone named Francis McAmey was its first moderator. You'll notice that's what my little statue there is in the corner. This statue, I think it ended up, let's see. This is in Virginia. The Presbyterian Historical Society established this little statue there in 1908. And the caption of it says, "In the memory of Francis McAmey, founder of American Presbyterianism." And so the Presbytery of Philadelphia started in 1706. So a presbytery, again, group of churches that are Presbyterian in conviction, similar theology, and they decide we need to have a presbytery because that's what Presbyterians do, right? They have presbyteries. And so that first one is formed in Philadelphia. And there was seven ministers. By the way, we don't even have the minutes from their first meeting. We have the minutes from their second meeting and thereafter, but the first meeting somehow have got lost, but people have been able to reconstruct what went on in that first meeting based on the second meeting's minute notes. And so there was seven ministers. One was an English Puritan, Jedediah Andrews, if you've ever heard that name. And the other six appear to be Scots-Irish Presbyterians. And as we mentioned, Francis McAmee was their moderator. And something interesting about Francis McAmee, he also faced persecution. He spent 5 months in jail, actually, for preaching in... I can't read my own notes here. Preaching somewhere in New England. I don't remember off the top of my head where it was. But he spent 5 months preaching... Or excuse me, 5 months in prison because he preached without a license. This is in the American New England area, right? He didn't have a license to preach. And when I say license, I don't mean from the church. I mean from the government. He had to get a license to preach, but he couldn't be licensed because of some of his Presbyterian views. And so this is what helped contribute to why we as Presbyterians often think so highly of Philadelphia being the sort of home of Presbyterianism. So William Penn was the one in charge of that colony. And unlike many of the colonies, he allowed religious freedom. He allowed different groups who weren't sort of state-sponsored religion to be able to come and exercise without coercion or without trouble from the government. And so Francis McAmee and other places in the New World would get thrown in jail for preaching, was able to come to Philadelphia and find freedom to preach as a Presbyterian. So this is something important for our background, is that we did not have a state sponsorship. Not only do we not have a mother church, but there was no colony that we could say, this is a Presbyterian government colony. That's not the way it was. And so what we find going into our history is Presbyterians have come out saying, we don't want to have a strong connection of church and state. That hasn't gone well for us. We've seen the troubles with that. We want the church to be able to do what the church is supposed to do without the government trying to control it, and let the government do what it's supposed to do without us trying to control the government. And that continues to be worked out in our history as well. Questions so far? Okay, so we have a presbytery in 1706, but we're still missing something. What did I mention is another thing that you usually have in a Presbyterian form of government. You've got the local church with local elders. You've got a regional area governed by delegates of those same elders. And then what does a Presbyterian government usually have above all that? GA, General Assembly, or Synods. That would be the whole denomination wide. And so the first Synod, which you could also just call General Assembly, was the Synod of Philadelphia. It's the next thing on your notes there, established in 1716. At that point, they had four initial presbyteries: Philadelphia, New York, Newcastle, which is Delaware, and Snow Hill, which was Maryland. Now, this is important. See, they came from the background of Scotland and England, and particularly the Church of Scotland had a Presbyterian form of government. And that all happened alongside the Protestant Reformation, where this national church becomes Presbyterian, and it's all been converted essentially at the same time to a Presbyterian form of government. And so in Scotland, the General Assembly, or the Synod, really had a lot of power, because it was kind of from the get-go seen as the highest body. But in this history, remember, the presbyteries actually existed before the General Assembly, before the Synod. And so it's clear in our own denomination today, and has been the case for American Presbyterianism, that presbyteries seem to have a lot more responsibility and power than General Assembly. Now, General Assembly does still, it's still our final court. And if something goes from the local church to the presbytery and up to General Assembly makes a final decision, and that is the highest court. But a lot is intentionally happening here on the presbytery level. One of the big reasons they made the presbytery, well, anybody want to guess why they form the presbytery, besides that it was consistent with their views, one of the main tasks they gave to presbyteries right from the start, it was to examine and ordain ministers. So remember I mentioned the need for ministers. And so they wanted to have some sort of control beyond just from a congregationalist level, which is what a congregationalist church might do, right? Just the local elders examine a man and ordain them. But they wanted to follow their presbytery convictions, and they thought this would be better to have on a presbytery level. And so that continues to be the case. Ministers aren't examined at General Assembly. They're examined on the presbytery level. And that has a lot of influence over the presbytery because they're saying who can preach in their pulpits, right? And who preaches in their pulpits and what they preach is going to greatly affect the nature of those churches. And it certainly is a case today where, for good or bad, some presbyteries have a little bit different leanings than others, and their ministers and how they conduct themselves are going to reflect that. And it should be the case that we all agree. But sometimes you can see little nuances, and certain presbyteries are willing to say, that's not okay, but this is okay, and they maybe not agree in all of that. Now, this, of course, leads up into the next point, the Adopting Act of 1729. In light of what I just said, between 1716 and 1729, what's still missing in what we think of as a formal Presbyterian government and operation? So we've got the local elders, we've got the presbyteries, we've got the General Assembly, but there's something still important that they need to be able to agree upon that would help unite them. Any thoughts? You can cheat and look at your notes here and figure it out. Judy.
I cheated.
You're good.
They didn't have a doctrinal standard that they could all agree on.
Yeah, they did not have a doctrinal standard. So yeah, I just mentioned presbyteries today. One presbytery, another might enforce certain things than another would. But they can't go too far astray or too far different today. Because we have something that says, here's what on a denominational level, in rather good detail, great detail, is going to define us. And that's what, you know, Mike had mentioned on day one, guided by our confessional standards. And what I then on week two talked about our confessionalism, right? That we have these Westminster standards, the Westminster Confession of Faith and the larger and shorter catechisms that was created in the Westminster Assembly back in London. And so by 1729, they realized we need to have a doctrinal standard that's not only on paper there, but that every minister who comes in is going to make sure they affirm this. And that means each presbytery, when they examine the men, that they have to examine to understand that what they are saying is accurate and true. Or in other words, that it aligns with the Westminster standards. And so that was an important point there. Now, do you think everyone thought this was a good idea? Seems like a good idea now for us, right? There was controversy on this. Some people, so it was called creedal subscription. Creedal subscription. Do we require people to sign on the dotted line on a man-made product? See, now when I put it that way, now maybe we can begin to understand the debate, right? Because what's the infallible standard of the church? The Bible, right? And so suddenly you put in a man-made document, and that can make some people uneasy. And that's been a concern, and it's still a concern today. Outsiders will often see how highly we make use of the Westminster standards and think that somehow we're putting it on par with the scriptures. That's not what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is to say, okay, this is the standard, the Word of God. And we believe that this document articulates how we understand this scripture. So for the purpose of unity, so for the purpose of protecting sound doctrine, for the purpose when we examine candidates, we all have the same standard of what we believe is important for our ministers to believe, that we need something to control that. And it's we mentioned it when we talked about subscription and confessionalism. It's clearly seen in denominations that don't have that. you can get some crazy things going on from the teaching and preaching. And so creedal subscription, the idea of having to affirm a confession, did win the day. And so we have the original Adopting Act here. And before I read the Adopting Act, I'm going to read you a little what they did in the morning session of the Adopting Act. And then I'm going to read you the Adopting Act. It says, this is, so you don't have, what I'm going to read now, you don't have in the morning session, you don't have in front of you. It says, although the Synod do not claim or pretend any authority of imposing our faith upon other men's consciences, but do profess our just dissatisfaction with and abhorrence of such impositions, and do utterly disdain or disclaim all legislative power and authority of such impositions, and do utterly disclaim all legislative and power and authority in the church, being willing to receive one another as Christ has received us to the glory of God, and to admit in fellowship to the sacred ordinances all such as we have grounds to believe Christ will at last admit to the kingdom of heaven, yet we are undoubtedly obliged to take care that the faith once delivered to the saints be kept pure and uncorrupt among us, and so hand down to our posterity, and do therefore agree that all ministers of this synod, or that shall hereafter be admitted into this synod, shall declare their agreement in and approbation of the confession of faith with the larger and shorter catechisms of the Assembly of Divines at Westminster, as being in all the essential and necessary articles, good forms of sound words and systems of Christian doctrine, and do also adopt the said confession and catechisms as the confession of our faith. And so this is an important thing here. Two things it says there, well, maybe several things, but I'll mention three, actually. So the first is, they don't want to impose upon as a judicial body and say, you have to believe, like somehow binding their conscience in some way that would be contrary to the Word of God. They're careful on that. They also want to say, we don't want to require people who come into the church and have communion with us, we don't want to put a standard upon them that is greater than the standard of becoming a Christian. You know, you can become a Christian without having to have read the Westminster Confession and affirmed it in its entirety. And so they want to be careful. They're not saying this is a requirement for members. But they are saying we have an obligation to guard what's taught and communicated from our pulpits. And so from our ministers, we're going to have them require them to be on the same page with us doctrinally. And therefore, they're going to need to affirm the Westminster standards. And it uses language in all the essential and necessary articles, which becomes a point of controversy I'll mention in a moment. But for now, then you have the actual Adopting Act is that afternoon in that same session. And so the ministers that are there then adopt it. So this sets out what I read a second ago, says this is our practice now going forward. So then all the ministers have to do it, right? They haven't done it yet, so now they're going to officially do it here in the Adopting Act. So this is known as the Adopting Act of 1729. It says, quote, all the ministers of this synod now present, except one that declared himself not prepared, after proposing all the scruples that any of them had to make against any articles and expressions in the Confession of Faith and larger and shorter catechisms of the Assembly of Divines at Westminster, have unanimously agreed in the solution of those scruples, and in declaring the said confession catechisms to be the confession of their faith, accepting only some clauses in the 20th and 23rd chapters, concerning which clauses the synod do unanimously declare that they do not receive those articles in any such sense as to suppose the civil magistrate hath a controlling power over synods with respect to the exercise of their ministerial authority, or a power to persecute any for their religion, or in any sense contrary to the Protestant succession to the throne of Great Britain. By the way, it says that the guy who was unprepared to do it, the next meeting, he affirmed it as well. So that's what the minutes record. So at this point, those ministers in the Presbyterian Church, they affirm the confession of their faith. And you notice, did someone catch they had an exception that they took then? Did you guys see the exception?
20th and 23rd chapters.
Yeah. And it mentions a little statement about what that's regarding. That was regarding references to the civil magistrate, to the civil government. Remember, some of these guys had faced persecution from the civil government for preaching. And the original Westminster standards affirm what you see in Scotland and England at the time, is that the government essentially has a role in which they can tell the church what to do in certain regards. And so later on, I assume we'll eventually get to it in our lessons, not today, but the Presbyterian Church will modify those chapters slightly and put more along the lines of what we think, which is if you look at our OPC, Westminster Confession of Faith, it's got that modification in there that says that the government and the church have their separate roles. There's ways in which they interact, and you can read about it in the Westminster Confession. But it's not that the government has the ability to, in any way, interfere with the church's business. And so that is a distinctively American form of Presbyterianism, not what you would find in Scotland, in the Church of Scotland. Unless you're in the Free Church of Scotland. That's what that word free means, in the Free Church of Scotland. They wanted less government meddling. So, anyways. That same meeting, and it's the point two there, I won't read it, but you have it there. They also at that time say the form of government with its discussion on discipline and the directory for worship, those documents which are attached to the Westminster Confession of Faith, what they built at the Westminster Assembly, we're also going to affirm the use of those in our midst. And so we find this today. I mentioned it when we looked at the Westminster Assembly lesson, that they did also create these other documents that described how the government should run, how the discipline should take place, the worship. And so with less powerful wording, they affirm those. And that's typically how we see it in American Presbyterian history. You've got often referred to the primary standards as the Bible, and then the Westminster Confession with the Catechism is called the secondary standards, and then sometimes it's referred to as the tertiary standards, which are the form of government, the book of discipline, and the directory for public worship. And so those things... Now, at this point, they have a constitution. What do they believe, and how are they going to conduct themselves? And so this is really now the Presbyterian Church in full swing. Questions? Marlon?
Does the OBC Book of Church Order, does it relate? I mean, is it kind of a succession from the Westminster Directory of Public Worship?
Yes. Yes. So if you... in fact, I was looking at some in-between documents along the way. Google has great. You know, it's got so much of these old archived documents digitized that you can view them. And looking at some of the process, you can see how it went from the Book of Church Order from the Westminster Assembly. You can see kind of how it's progressively getting revised and to what we have today. So to answer Marlon's point a little bit more, though, the Confession and the Catechisms have had very little changes. The Book of Church Order, the government and the worship directory and the Book of Discipline, they've experienced quite a bit more updates. And I think that's helpful because I think there's a lot more theological reflection put into place on the Confession and Catechisms, and they're really about doctrine. The other ones have a little bit of doctrine in there, and those are the parts that have been updated the least. But the parts that have been updated are really the practical side. Those other documents have a lot more practicality, like how many votes do you need for this? What are the steps you go through when filing a charge against someone in terms of the form of the charge? And so there's a lot more pragmatic stuff in there, and there is a lot of changes. But in our case, for the OPC, we recently came out with a new directory for worship, which has been pretty much completely revamped. So that, at that point, is going to look a lot different maybe than their directory. The substance is the same, but kind of how it's organized is pretty significantly different. If you go back to the one just before that and look, you can see quite a similarity in terms of like chapter headings are often the same, or this chapter has been broken up into two chapters, stuff like that. So, yeah. I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, I was wondering, yeah. Is it an incremental change, I guess, from today?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Good. All right. So other thing to mention now here at this last point is to say that this became now an ongoing discussion of what's called strict subscription or system subscription. See, when they passed that morning motion that said you had to agree with the confession and catechisms and all its essential and necessary doctrines, was that saying that everybody could come in and lay out their exceptions and then the presbytery would have to decide if that's acceptable or not? That's what the system subscription people would say. The strict subscription people would say, no, 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 they were only talking about chapter 20 and 23 about the civil government. That's the only exception you're really allowed to make. Now, so that's been a sort of ongoing debate. To what degree do we affirm or, you know, allowed to have some form of scruple or exception? And the reality is both sides do allow some degree of exception or scruple. The question often becomes to what degree, to what substance of the exception. So there are still some in-house discussions and debate on how this works itself out in practice. But by all means, it's so much better than having no real substantive doctrinal statement, even though we may have some of these debates. Now, we're running low on time, and that's okay, even though it looks like we still have a lot to talk about, because most of what I'm going to do today is going to introduce these ideas, which Mike, in his lesson, I think, is going to touch on a lot of these things and run with them even further. So I'm hoping to kind of set Mike up for next time. He's going to talk about what's called the old side, new side controversy. But one of the problems we've mentioned is the need to educate ministers. And think about where the schools were. Where were the schools?
In the East.
They were in Europe. Very far east, so you're right. Really, all the real schools were back in Europe at this time, right? At this early stage. And these are just colonies getting off the ground still. And so if you wanted somebody who was really trained, you would send him to one of these prestigious schools back in Europe, back in England. And so one of the earliest seminary schools in the New World, particularly for Presbyterians, the first one really serving Presbyterian convictions, was something called the Log College, created by a Presbyterian minister called William Tennant. And this only ran for a short time from 1726 to 1746. And by the way, he didn't name it the Log College. The actual name was a much more prestigious sounding name. Log College was what people outside started to call it. And it was really, in a sense, meant as more of a derogatory term. You know, you've got all these fancy, prestigious European schools, and then you create this little, the college was, I guess, made of logs. It's like a log cabin type building. And, you know, it's kind of like you're training these poor farm boys theology. And instead of sending the, you know, people better trained, go back to these European schools. So there was a bit of a derogatory intention by calling it Log College. One of the things, though, that particularly becomes noteworthy for Mike's lesson next week is a lot of the people who graduate from Log College go on to be rather well-known revivalist preachers and contribute to the old side, new side controversy, and as Mike will get into, they're on the new side. So what's produced from this college really is a certain mold of a Presbyterian that is going to compete or be a conflict for people who will call themselves old side. And so Mike will get into that more next time. And we mentioned it here just by way of reference, since we're talking about seminaries here. Eventually in 1812, Princeton Theological Seminary is established by the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church. That's in Princeton, New Jersey. By the way, it is different than Princeton University, but some of the people involved in Princeton University were helpful in getting Princeton Seminary off the ground. And again, they're trying to solve the shortage of educated ministers. At that time, we'll talk about it more later, the shortage is because of the westward expansion. Now you're having colonies, you know, in the West, the Wild West, and you need ministers. And so here was a chance to have a more serious academic seminary that is going to promote Reformed theology here in America. And so that was what it was trying to do. And at that time, up until the 1920s and 30s, Princeton Theological Seminary was a real staunch defender and promoter of Orthodox confessionally Reformed theology. A lot of great guys taught there during that time, and were really helpful in so many ways. I'm sure we'll talk more about that as we go along. So the last thing to note here is the First Great Awakening. Let me ask, who's heard of the First Great Awakening? Heard any Great Awakenings? So some of you have, okay. This was a revival movement in the United States. It was not distinct to just Presbyterianism. So among Protestant evangelical Christians, there was this revival movement taking place. And this would have been like in the 1730s and 1740s. So we're back more in the time frame now we've been talking about. And it's really characterized by an emphasis on greater emotional connection to Christianity, a greater sort of passion coming forth in your faith, and really looking suspect on people who maybe can't express that the way that others want it to be expressed, and even to the point of, if you don't have like some fancy conversion story, we might suspect whether you're actually converted. I'm already starting to get into some of the issues Mike's going to get into next week, I'm sure in more detail, but often what came along with that was a less concern for doctrine. Does that sound at all familiar? Passion and zeal versus doctrine, and that's some of the controversy we still face today. This is really the first real time that it came in America to such an extreme way. And there was a lot of excitement going on at the time. People were largely excited about this preaching that was going on that brought about the Great Awakening. And a lot of emphasis on reaching to people who were coming to church every week, but maybe didn't seem too excited about their faith. So historians, not just Presbyterian historians, look at what went on there, and something went on. But as Mike will get into next week, what it was, some of the bad things that came along with that too. And so he'll delve into that controversy. But this is a time of people like Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards is really one of the main guys attributed to getting the Great Awakening going. And you had George Whitefield also. He was a Calvinist. He had a lot of similar theology, but he's also a big itinerant preacher. And Mike, I'm sure we'll get into next week, itinerant preaching was not something that a lot of the Presbyterians were excited about. You know, someone just showing up at your church ready to preach. I'm sure going about more, but you also had people like John Wesley. So the Methodist movement, really, that was the birthplace of Methodism, and it was related to some of the issues we're talking about today. Another Presbyterian minister was named Samuel Davies, and he spent a lot of time ministering to blacks, and thought that, hey, they should be theologically well-trained too, and really doing a lot of ministry to them, and a lot of evangelism to that community. So that's a little bit about what you'll be heading more next week. Any questions? Any other questions? We got about 1 or 2 minutes for questions.
It's Mike? A question, but it's more of a comment with the education part.
Mm.
And how that's actually still relevant today. How the they had to send people before out back to England,
yeah,
to get them trained to come back. And there's a great allure, with the, oh man, I have to go back, and the journey. I can be comfortable here, And we still see that, not in the United States, but in other places. I when I was in seminary, I heard stories about people would come from like Africa, other countries to study because they had no real place to study anywhere else, and would you're 3 or 4 years, you're done, and like, well, do I want to go back to minister where I was? Or, I can get pretty comfortable here, actually. And seeing actually a lot of people who have been starting seminaries in, Uganda, other places in Africa, in South America, wherever it is, so that they can actually, one, it's more affordable for those people to come, but also so, they go there and then they can just minister back in their context where they go. And in a way, that's kind of like what was going on here. We got to form seminaries to train guys here, because it's going to be a lot easier. That's ultimately how we're going to be sustained.
And I appreciate you mentioning that, because it's actually the last thing on my notes I was going to mention, even taking one step back. In general, the things we talked about are a lot of lessons for growing. So if you look at how we do foreign missions in other places, this is so similar to, like, for example, Uruguay. Uruguay right now, the mission work we're doing right now is a few scattered, technically independent church plants led by some Reformed missionaries. But they're already talking, let's form a presbytery. And they're not quite there, but they're already working toward it. Similar things are going on in China right now, and they're working on coming up with a book of church order for them. And so, you know, you start as independent church plants, begin to start a presbytery, and then hopefully have other presbyteries, and we can end up having a general assembly. And if you're going to do that, then what are you going to need? You're going to need trained ministers. And that's definitely, like Mike said, I've seen a lot of that same thing happening. It's much better to live in America, these people realize. And they go, oh, we're here. So let's have a seminary out there so they hopefully don't leave after they get trained. Because those local areas need ministers. But what comes along with this kind of growth like this and formalizing establishment often comes growing pains. And so then you get some of the controversies and the discussions and hopefully work through them. And that again will lead us up into next week where we see probably their first biggest main controversy is this old side, new side controversy. So, well, we're out of time. Let's go ahead and close in prayer.